Yeah. Lisa. All right, kia ora everyone. I think we'll get started because we're just about five after, which is normally when we start class. So I'd like to welcome Emeritus Professor Julie Park to our class. Make sure she's in the frame here. So I think what we'll do is we'll just do a little bit of an intro first and ask Julie to talk a little bit about her career and how the kinds of research she's done in New Zealand, being a medical anthropologist from New Zealand who's done medical anthropology in New Zealand and of New Zealand. And then we'll open it up to questions from you about anything that Julie's talked about or about the reading that was assigned on hemophilia this week or anything about sort of being a medical anthropologist, doing medical anthropology, any questions you have. It's really quite open, I think. Yeah, I don't know. Julie, do you want to introduce yourself?
Kia ora koutou. It's lovely to be here. And thanks, Heather, for inviting me or offering me the opportunity to come and talk to you this class. I used to teach the medical anthropology class when it was at stage three for many years at Auckland University. And it was one of my favourites, and I'm sure it still is for Heather and Susanna. Right, Heather's asked me to talk a little bit about my life as an anthropologist, which is I started studying anthropology in 1965, which is probably before even your parents were born. So it's quite a long career now. And in those days, I was working at Otago University. There wasn't such a thing as medical anthropology in terms of courses in New Zealand, though of course there was research going on into health and medical issues and different groups of people's ideas around health and well-being, stuff on political economy, which of course is one of the underlying features that lead to equity or structural violence and so on. So that work was going on, but it wasn't gathered together in particular courses called medical anthropology for quite a few years after that. But my interests in the area were peaked in my third year as an undergraduate at Otago when we undertook some study in a rural area of New Zealand. I won't go into the details of that, but I could see that that was a great area to work in. And I really enjoyed doing field work, which involved spending days or half days with farmers around the place, talking to them about some of their concerns and working in a team. So that was quite a formative experience for me. And I should urge you, when you're eligible to apply for things like summer studentships and research studentships, it's a great thing to do. And you might find that it does indicate where you might want to work through the later part of your life. So I'll just talk a little bit about some of the studies that I've done. I've worked in parts of the Pacific as well as New Zealand, but today I'm talking only about the New Zealand work, or primarily about the New Zealand work. So my PhD was set in a psychiatric hospital, and I was looking at the social relations within that hospital and how they led to the creation of different groups and in some ways interfered with therapeutic processes that were going on. And after that, I was quite struck when I was working in this hospital as to how sane many of the people who were labelled as patients were and what difficult lives they'd been leading. And particularly as a young woman myself, I was interested in the stories of women, old and young, and the very oppressive lives some of them had been leading in their families and particularly in their marriages. And these were women of all ages from town and country. So my next lot of studies were really all set in communities. And the first one was about a new community in Auckland, newish community, a new built community, and particularly the lives of women and families in that place and how they strove to bring up their children and live good lives and be good family women and sometimes men. Mostly it was focused on women. following that, I was working as an independent researcher at that time, getting research grants from various agencies that give out research grants. I developed an interest in the lives of New Zealand women. Well, I should say it had been an interest of mine for a long time, but I managed to put together a project with lots of new graduates from both Auckland and Otago universities to study the place of alcohol in New Zealand women's lives. And we worked in cities, country towns, country areas, and with a whole range of different groups within New Zealand. So, for example, and within those groups, we tried to share our research skills with local researchers. So, for example, in the study that was specifically focused with Māori women, we worked with Māori Nurses Association. With Tongan and Samoan women, we tried to work, or Cook Islands and Samoan women, we did work with researchers whom we supported from those communities. Same with research with lesbian women, we worked with the Lesbian Women's Collective and so on. And that's been a bit of a pattern of my research, and those of you who've actually read the final chapter in the book on haemophilia that was published last year, that's this one here, which is available online in the library, will have noticed that that final chapter included the voices of two members of the haemophilia community who are co-authors on our book, and two anthropologists, both from at that time from the University of Auckland. But that's getting ahead of myself quite a bit. So the work with women, women, the place of alcohol in the lives of New Zealand women, led to the publication in, I think it was 1990 or 1991, it might have been, of the book Ladies of Plate, which was an edited volume written by the researchers who'd been the key in the research team that had gone on and done all this this work with communities in New Zealand. And around this time, I got appointed to the University of Auckland. That was in 1990. And finally to a permanent position in 1993. And it wasn't long after that I and colleagues started working towards creating the first medical anthropology paper at the University of Auckland, which I think you have to go through a whole lot of processes, as Heather will know, to create a new paper. It takes a year or 18 months often to get it approved at all the different levels. And I think we taught the first class in 1996, which was a bit of a milestone. So during this time at the University of Auckland, I had colleagues on tap to work with. So I worked with some colleagues in the Samoan community and Samoan academics on a study of roles and responsibilities in reproduction, and with Māori academics and a whole range of Pacific groups on giving babies a good start in life, things like that. And continued working with different communities. And it was at this time, in 1993, that I started working with the haemophilia community. And that's described in the paper that you've read, so I won't go into it in great detail. But that's been the long running, as you can see, 1993 is quite a while ago. That's my long running ethnographic engagement with the community, and I still am involved. Went to their 60th anniversary party of the Haemophilia Foundation at the end of last year. Seems strange, doesn't it? Just flying to Wellington, no thought about anything, pop on a plane, go to Wellington and come back. Nowadays, it's a little more scary, or expensive or difficult, but it seems like a lifetime away. And during the 1990s, Professor Judith Littleton was appointed to our department, and we started teaching the medical anthropology course together, which we enjoyed very much. And from that teaching engagement and friendship, we also started studying tuberculosis in New Zealand. And that's my second really long-running study. And actually, we've just submitted a paper the other day. So we're still, working on some aspects of that. And that's the one that most directly led me into work in the Pacific. But we also studied tuberculosis in New Zealand. And for me, it's really interesting to look at the differences between tuberculosis and haemophilia. And one of the students, I think it was Lisa, asked about, is haemophilia stigmatized in New Zealand? And I'd like to talk about that in relation to haemophilia and TB, if that's okay with you, Lisa. Because haemophilia itself is not a particularly stigmatized condition. It can be, kids can be bullied because, you know, they can't play rugby and they can't sometimes run around or play contact sports like other kids if they're having a bleed. But particularly nowadays, when their bleeds are so well controlled with clotting factor replacement provided free in New Zealand by our government from our taxes, there's very little stigmatisation. But during the periods when the blood, when it was, the treatment was through human blood, now it's by recombinant products which don't have any human blood in them. When it was in human blood, then the blood got infected with hepatitis C and HIV. And during that time, haemophilia was stigmatized through association with those other infectious conditions. So it is a complicated answer of both yes and no, but as it, in itself, haemophilia is no more stigmatized than, say, having a broken leg or, you know, having a broken arm or something like that. It can lead to bullying and teasing, but it itself is not particularly stigmatized. But there are some interesting things. So in our study, we heard both from an English immigrant and a Maori participant that they had haemophilia in their family because of a familial curse. Somebody had done something wrong and a grandmother or somebody had cursed, and that's why they had haemophilia. So it was stigmatized within the family in that way, but nobody outside would know that that particular haemophilia was thought to be the result of a familial curse. So it is a complicated thing. But when you come to tuberculosis, that is highly stigmatized. So much so that we work with a number of different communities in New Zealand, in Auckland, as well as historical studies. And then later on, we worked in the Island Pacific with Pacific scholars. So, for example, when a person has tuberculosis, until they're treated for a couple of weeks, they can be infectious. And in that couple of weeks, either they're in isolation, a bit like people with COVID or wondering if they have COVID, or else they're in hospital if they need hospital treatment. And if they are very infectious and not 100% able to keep themselves isolated, then they'll be in hospital. But they're not discharged from hospital until they're no longer infectious. In other words, they can't rustle up enough tuberculosis bacillus when they cough or sneeze or sing to infect anybody in the community. But we had examples of a student actually, returning to his flat after coming out of hospital and finding all his things on the front path, and he'd no longer had a room. We had an older guy in one of those rather seedy boarding houses that there still are around the place in Auckland, who got up at night and got his meals and everything, because he was afraid of the stigma from his co-residents in his boarding house. We have people in some of the migrant communities who tried to keep tuberculosis secret in their family for a range of reasons, but particularly because nobody would marry the children if they thought that was a bad family with tuberculosis. And the idea of a bad family is part of the stigmatization of tuberculosis. So I've probably said enough about that and enough about my career. Now I'm retired, which means I have more time to write stuff and do my garden.
Okay, well, I want to give you guys some time to ask questions. So if you like, you can pop a question into the chat. type it in, or if you want to, you know, put up your hand, unmute your mic, and ask that way too. That's fine either way.
And I've got these questions here that Lisa put on.
Yeah, and so while you guys are thinking of some questions, maybe we'll
we've had some written questions already.
We'll address some of Lisa's questions again.
So she had a quick question really about the Haemophilia Foundation. How's it doing? Well, the main worry, I imagine you mean now during the time of COVID-19, Lisa, I'm not really sure, because that chapter's up to about 2018. So nothing too much has changed. But during COVID-19, in the early days, there was a real concern about supply of haemophilia treatment products. The country always stockpiles 3 to 6 months worth of products, but nobody knew at that time what was going to happen to the freight, the international freight. So all the stuff has to come in from overseas. But fortunately, because of all the good relationships there were, and Pharmac was really excellent in this regard, there has been no shortage of products in New Zealand. So people have been able to go about their daily lives in the normal way. In terms of the Haemophilia Foundation, it's got its outreach workers and so on in the as described in our book, but it's trying to move more to online stuff. And of course, it was really hurried along by COVID-19. So the outreach workers will do some of their work at the moment is still online. So they visit with people virtually around in all the different country areas in New Zealand where people with haemophilia live, and talk to them online. So that's another change. And I think the because haemophilia is quite a rare condition or disease, or whatever you want to call it, condition is the term I like to use, you have to have quite a decent sized population in New Zealand of any one group in order to have anyone with haemophilia in it. And also because of our immigration laws, people with disorders and conditions that are going to cost the government a lot of money are not usually permitted to immigrate to New Zealand. So this means that it's only relatively recently when groups apart from Maori and Pacific have started to come to New Zealand in big numbers that the Haemophilia Foundation has really reflected or started to reflect, not entirely, but to some extent, the diversity that is here in New Zealand society. And because in every generation, about a third of the haemophilia is a new mutation, we'll expect over time for the numbers to increase in all the different more recent migrant communities. So now there is more ethnic diversity than there was when we first started our research, and that is greatly recognised. And also the Māori arm of the Haemophilia Foundation, you know, has gone from strength to strength once it was established quite a few years ago. So these are some of the changes that are happening in the contemporary times. That was one of your questions. The other, another question was, I'll just read it out. What was anthropology's impact on your perception of what it means to live in Aotearoa New Zealand regarding the healthcare system? And I think that's a really good question, because one of the things that I'm sure Heather and Susanna have been talking about is about causes of causes, about structural violence, inequality, globalization, and the one world movement where, you know, humans are not the only thing in the world. There's animals and there's our environment, and we are impacting on our environment in ways which make, like COVID-19 unfortunately probably has shown us, make life more dangerous for people, and sometimes very often for animals as well, and other forms of life. So that I do think that you know, anthropology has a great deal to offer helping us look upstream and see what is going on, and also look downstream and see what are our effects. I think one thing I'd like to mention, and that is that I'm always learning in anthropology. You know, I started in 1965, as I mentioned. But, you know, I'm still learning about new ways of doing things. And that's been brought home to me in the last week or two, because my colleague in Otago, Ruth Fitzgerald, Professor Ruth Fitzgerald, and I have worked together a lot on different things. I forgot to mention a whole study, but never mind. That she and I have been doing. And we did a paper about 10 years ago in a Companion to Medical Anthropology, an international publication by Wiley Blackwell or somebody. And we've just been asked to update the chapter because there's going to be a new digital edition of this great big fat tome, which weighs about 10 ton and costs, I don't know, $300 or something. Anyway, so a digital edition will be much more accessible. But it's really interesting. In the last 10 years, you know, looking at how things are changing and how ideas are changing as well. So, you know, the thing about anthropology is that it provides many theoretical perspectives. I think of a theory as a disciplined way of thinking through a subject or an issue or a problem. And in the last 10 years, there's some new ways of thinking about the chapter that we're writing, which is called Biotechnology and Care. And there's new ways of thinking about care and new ways of thinking about biotechnology, which we're trying to squeeze into a few hundred words. So I'm always learning. So I think that's an orientation that anthropology is makes us very open to learning. And also, because of our cross-cultural perspective, makes us attentive to inequities of all sorts, not just ethnic and racialized ones, but to do with gender and sexuality and the place of poverty and the creation of poverty through the systems and the economic systems in which we're embedded and that sort of thing. So that's a bit of a long answer, but there you go.
We had another question from Carissa. She says, okay, so this is for Julie Spray, I think. Yeah, Julie Spray on Wednesday.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll save that for Wednesday. I'll put that aside and make sure we ask Julie on Wednesday.
Two
Julies. I'm sure it's confusing.
Yes, it was confusing while we're in the department together. She's Julie S and I'm Julie P.
Yeah, so if you've got questions, yeah, pop them into the chat or just stick your hand up and we can unmute you and you can ask Julie Park here. Do you have any thoughts on COVID-19 and research, anything?
Well, one of the theoretical perspectives that Judith Littleton and I have been working with for some years now is that of syndemic perspectives. Mm. And have they heard about that?
A little bit, I think, because they had a lecture from Judith a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
So I think she would have mentioned syndemics.
Yeah, so that's when relationships that you might think of as, say, comorbidity or a factor such as poverty or something are brought into real relationships through research and the social and political and economic are not separated out from the more sort of biological. And so this can be applied to human development, or it can be applied to pandemics or epidemics, or just the state of health in a particular situation. So in I will talk a little bit about our work in the Pacific, because we explicitly used a syndemic framework there to look at tuberculosis. We were working in two different countries. One had a low or non-existent tuberculosis rate, and the other had a relatively high but diminishing tuberculosis rate. And so we needed to look at the history of those two former colonies and the amount of resources and infrastructure that the colonial authorities had afforded those countries, because that was an important factor in their current situation. We needed to look at other aspects of public health and current funding situations and current political relationships to see what was going on. Both countries had fairly high rates of diabetes. We had diabetes is now a well-researched, is in a well-researched relationship with tuberculosis and vice versa. Each has effect on the other to make the condition more difficult to treat and worse. But one of the things that we explored was the relationship between tuberculosis and worms, you know, and parasitic worms. And we did find that there definitely is a relationship there, working on the our immune systems, and that goes back to during pregnancy and the mother's status in regard to infestation with hookworm. And our immune systems, without our say-so, are up if your mother has hookworm while you're in the womb, are upregulated to combat the hookworm. But unfortunately, at the same time, it's downregulated in ways which make you more susceptible to tuberculosis. So, you know, one of the things that I've learned as a medical anthropologist is how incredibly complex human bodies are. And you know, that's I think there'll be all sorts of really interesting things that we find out about COVID-19, about how in some countries there's been very little COVID-19, and what there has been has not been, you know, as ghastly fatal as it has been in some other countries. And these are very, you know, very interesting things to tease out. So I think a syndemic framework applying to COVID-19 is, you know, is really very important. And this will take into account the political system, which of course is having such dire consequences in say, for example, the UK, the US, and Brazil. But in a country like Mongolia, which has got China on one side and Russia on the other, there've been almost no cases, you know, and you just wonder, you know, what's going on there. And I think that there'll be work for years to come on trying to figure out how some countries have done so well in all sorts of different regards, not just through the medical aspects, but particularly through the social. And you'll note with some wryness, I imagine, that the response to COVID-19 has been almost entirely social. It's society which has saved us or dobbed us in. It's not, you know, the medical teams that, you know, do wonderful work at the bottom end, at the bottom of the cliff. You know, I don't want to denigrate them at all. It's been fantastic. But the measures to keep that fence up at the top have all been entirely social.
We've got some questions coming in.
Oh, good.
First from Emily. She says, in what ways do you think your research and your findings have impacted or are impacting health outcomes? Has there been positive changes that have come out of your research?
Maybe I can talk about a couple of things, including the hemophilia one. You don't know from just reading the final chapter of this book, but there was a huge struggle within the hemophilia community, including people, the doctors who are most closely working with people with hemophilia, to get a good system for hemophilia treatment going in New Zealand, and that finally was achieved in about 2008. It took years of struggle, and our research fed into that, and even the past president of the Hemophilia Foundation has cited it as being one of those things that helped them get towards this treatment being equitable in New Zealand, because we worked all throughout New Zealand and we were able to show that people with exactly the same levels of hemophilia were having really, really different life chance outcomes, whether they live, say, in Wellington, the West Coast, or Auckland. And we were able to give both statistical and life story evidence, you know, to back this up. it wasn't entirely our study, of course. There was a study commissioned by one of the big consulting companies that looked at the supply of haemophilia treatment products and showed that they weren't equitable and so on and so forth. So, you know, it was a combined effort. And of course, the doctors, they called treaters in the haemophilia community, the haematologists and haemophilia specialists and the Haemophilia Foundation were all working towards the same goal. So that was the one. But there's also other sorts of outcomes. So, for example, quite a few of my students are working in areas where they themselves have very direct input into either their country, if they're, say, from a Pacific nation, because they're either high up in the political situation or they're high up in the government, you know, the government departments and so on. Or here in New Zealand, working as health consultants or in district health boards or in ministries around the place. So, you know, there's two, so I've just given you two examples. One is the research feeding in, and the other is the teaching and the supervision of students feeding into positive outcomes.
Great. And a question from Rena. I was wondering what you think about how the field of haemophilia research might change in future years with the potential for accessibility of gene therapy. Do you think it's possible for gene therapy to be more accessible in the future in New Zealand?
Yeah, I think it is quite possible. It is looking pretty promising. But more immediately is a long-acting treatment product. So it used to be that people with haemophilia all had to be treated somewhere between twice a week and seven times a week. And that the seven is unusual, but it does happen. And this is home treatment. It's intravenous treatment, so it's very tough on your veins and also just tough on you. And so recently, there's been a lot of work put into extending the half-life of the haemophilia treatment products. There's a whole chapter on this in the book. It's quite complicated. Gene therapy had a rather a bumpy start with some very unfortunate outcomes early on. But now there have been some pretty good trials, and New Zealanders can take part in these trials through international databases. Both developments look as though they're going to really revolutionise treatment in the future. I should clarify that gene therapy for haemophilia is not like one thing, you know, one change in gene and you're good for life. It's not like that at all. It'll just be less frequent treatment, and it probably won't need an intravenous injection. Mm-hmm. So that some of the trials show that gene therapy is having positive effects for more than 12 months, you know, so this would make a huge difference, because by the time people with haemophilia are now living into old age, their life expectancy is the same as anybody else's, and their veins are getting absolutely shot from those multiple IVs that they've had three times a week, every week of their lives from when they're about two. So, yeah, you can see that gene therapy would be terrific, but it's a treatment. It's not, you know, necessarily a cure. That's not to say that in the future some gene manipulation might work, but at the moment what gene therapy will be is having a vector, maybe a denaturalized HIV virus that transports the little bit of gene that's not working properly in the person. I hope that makes sense.
Great. So let's see where we're at for time. We have time for a few more questions. So just if you've got any, pop them into the chat. Maybe I'll ask you, since we've got students who may be thinking about going into medical anthropology for postgrad, mm-hmm. or thinking about using it in your career, in their careers. Do you have any advice for them if they're sitting at stage two as to what maybe they could plan to do? And you mentioned summer scholarships.
Yes, I think the summer scholarships, as long as, you know, that any participating in any research will be helpful. And I think it's really good not to specialise too much at the undergraduate level. That's my view anyway. I know it's not what everyone says, but, you know, so making sure you take papers and classes in political anthropology, economic anthropology, biological anthropology of various sorts, and worldview and religion. That's also a really good one for medical anthropology, because you have to be able to cope with the idea that biomedicine is just one medicine among many others, and each has their ups and downs, the upsides and downsides, and their ways of thinking about the world that people inhabit, and so worldview and religion is good for that. So, you know, but certainly taking advantage of the papers that, you know, that focus on medical anthropology. I think I'm not sure what's, you know, being taught at the moment, so I can't recommend particular papers. But then when you go into graduate studies, if that's what your trajectory is, making sure that your thesis pulls together some of those things that you want to do for your life, and gives you some of the skills that you'll need in areas of non-government organisations. Most of the students that I've taught, they're working in public service very often, sometimes in commercial in firms doing research and stuff, but particularly in like ministries and government departments and NGOs that deal with health and well-being and women's issues and you know, equity and human rights, working for UN type organisations, and you know, internationally doing that sort of work as well, as well as the ones who've gone into academic careers, of course.
Good. So I don't see any more questions coming in. Is there anything else that you did? You mentioned some research that you forgot to talk about.
Oh, yeah, well, yes, I don't know why I slipped that mind. This really grew out of, this research that I didn't even talk about, grew out of my research with haemophilia, and my colleague Ruth Fitzgerald at Otago, who's an anthropologist, research with lots of communities that deal with genetic conditions and reproduction. And so we got a Marsden grant some years ago about ethical thinking, really, around the intersection of genetic conditions and reproduction. And so we've been working on that for a while now, and that's also informed this paper I was mentioning about biotechnology and care, and, you know, published a few things on it as well. And one of the things that we are trying to show with our studies, which are at all levels of society, so we've analysed submissions to Parliament, we've analysed parliamentary debates, we've worked with communities with genetic conditions, we've worked with the technologists and scientists that do the cytology and the embryology and so on as well. So we've tried to spread our interest in that. What we've been trying to work on is what's the ethical reasoning that people use to make the decisions that they do make, and how can we understand that? And to some extent, we're working against some of the taken for granted bioethical principles that you find all ethics committees use, and we've talked about, you know, the very broad thinking that ordinary people go into when they're trying to decide whether or not to have a baby, knowing that baby may have a particular genetic condition. And we tried to choose conditions which were the sorts of ones that everybody almost everybody says, well, if I knew I was going to have a baby like that, I'd definitely consider having an abortion or having prenatal genetic diagnosis or one of those technologies that are now available. Through to other conditions, such as deafness, where people wouldn't consider any of this technology around reproduction in order to prevent a deaf child being born. So so the things that people talk about is not just their individual decision, not even just their family's decision, but the effects that that will have on their community and the effects that their decisions will have on the wider society. So I'll just cite a couple of the haemophilia examples because they're always in my mind. Like one young girl said, I'm glad that these technologies are available, but I'd never want to use it because what if the only people that were born with haemophilia were people that didn't know anything about it? In other words, these 30% of mutations that occur, and they wouldn't have the political backing, they wouldn't be able to struggle for their rights and so on. And all of us people who've had generations of knowing about haemophilia, you know, we wouldn't be there because we wouldn't be having these children. So, you know, this is a very broad thinking. And so even though haemophilia is a serious condition, but it's highly treatable. And then in deaf communities, nobody would even think about having, it's quite distasteful for them. And like one of the women I was talking to said, well, how, you know, for us it's like this, how would you feel if a Māori person had an abortion because the child they were going to have was Māori? It's the same for us in deaf culture. If you say, I'm going to have pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or I'm going to have an abortion because I've got a child who's going to be deaf, it's exactly the same for us. It's, you know, basically genocide. And I mean, she wasn't angry, she was just explaining that she thinks about deaf culture the way she thinks Māori people think about Māori culture, and she was trying to get that, you know, across to me, which she did very well, as you can gather. And then, of course, there's people who have conditions like muscular dystrophy, for whom it's not really an issue for reasons that are too complicated to go into now, but cystic fibrosis and so on, that you know, do consider having not so much abortions if they can possibly avoid it, but pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which is also a very big trial, but it doesn't involve aborting a fetus. So, you know, and they're thinking very much about the well-being of the child that's going to be born. So this is why Ruth and I are writing this thing on biotechnologies and care, because we want to explore some of the other ways of thinking about ethics that, you know, are not codified in bioethical manuals so much. So they are much more now because of people like us pushing away there.
Great. We have another question from Lisa. Did exposure to different conditions and case studies change your perspective on what it means to be sick? Did being exposed to these different approaches to a certain condition relativize sickness and health for you?
I'm not sure how to answer that.
Were there people who maybe didn't consider themselves sick in the same way that you would think?
Yeah, now people with haemophilia don't consider themselves sick at all. They, you know, they think they have this thing in their blood which doesn't work. But then, you know, they're not sick unless they have the flu or something, in which case they are sick, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that it changed my thinking too much about, or relativize it, but we always teased one of our master's students, who did a study with some young men about how they thought about health and well-being. And we compared the way they rated their own health with the way guys with haemophilia and often HIV and hepatitis C rated their own health. And the guys that are the you know, what we thought of as quite well guys with that our student was working with, rated their health more poorly than the men with haemophilia. And so we thought this was kind of odd, and we teased him as having wimps for participants, which was not very, shall we say, relative at all. But in fun, but we urged him to dig deeper and try and find out why these men that seemed to be quite well from the outside were rating their health so lowly, and not to think of them just as wimps. And what he found was that these young men were all comparing themselves, can you believe it, to the All Blacks. And they thought, compared with the All Blacks, their health wasn't so good, especially their physical fitness. So it's the, in terms of relativities, it does depend what you compare yourself with, definitely, as to whether you think of yourself as full of well-being or sick. Or I think for these young men, it was more not as well as they could be kind of thing, rather than that they really thought they were very sick. But it was quite notable that they rated their health on a lower scale than people with haemophilia. So maybe somebody would like to comment on that.
Yeah, it's sort of glass half full, glass half empty. If you're comparing yourself, I'm not as well, as healthy as I could be, or if you've got a condition where you I could potentially be very sick, I'm not as sick as I could be, and therefore...
Well, you know, some of the guys with haemophilia would say, well, as long as I can walk, I'm doing well. Mm-hmm. And so if being able to walk is the basis of your well-being, then if you can walk well, you're going to rate yourself highly. But if being a top of the line All Black is your bottom line, then you're not going to rate yourself so highly. I know that's not quite answering the question, but it's sort of answering about the relativities that are involved. It's sort of who you compare yourself with.
Yeah, so I guess, I don't know if there's any more questions. We're coming up to almost an hour. So maybe if anyone's got any last minute questions, get them in before we wrap up. You're welcome. On behalf of Julie.
Oh, okay. There's this one here.
Ah, yes, Carissa. I missed that. What do you think are some of the reasons for a disconnect between policy and social activism when it comes to health inequities and how they are treated?
Well, that's a pretty big question. I'll try and be quick. One of them is money and resources. That's very, I think that's very important. And people tend to think that there's limited budgets. And in some cases there are real limits on budgets, but in other cases it's to do with priorities and allocation. So someone else has got a prior claim. The way to redress health inequalities is to redress inequalities, basically, at the community level. And that means spending money in areas where there's deprivation. And areas where there's deprivation are not... this is a complicated question, and this is a quick answer, but areas in which there's deprivation are not always the ones that our members of parliament are most concerned to listen to, unless other people make a fuss on their behalf. So I think, you know, there are lots of complicated answers involved in this, but one of the things in I think chapter 6 in our book, we show where it actually worked, that social activism managed to reverse policy and, in this case, get haemophilia treatment sorted, but also get redress for the wrongs done by the department and then the Ministry of Health in relation to not protecting the health of people with haemophilia by doing everything they could to keep hepatitis C out of the blood supply. It took years for any redress to happen, but it did in the end. So there's quite a good example of how it can be successful, but unfortunately, quite a bit depends on luck. Timing is another way of talking about luck. Timing is really important.
What was it about the timing for this one that
It was a political, there was a political crisis going on, and it was able to be sort of injected into that.
All right. Well, do you have any other thoughts that you want to impart?
Well done for doing metaplanthropology, and it's now the end of the semester, which has been a difficult semester for you all. So good on you for sticking with it, and have a lovely holiday.
Yeah. One last question. Do you think medical anthropology can give a voice to marginalized groups by studying them? I guess if you're working in partnership.
Yeah, I think only if you're working in partnership. And I think, you know, the way that I've always tried to do it is to give the resources that are created by the joint engagement in research to people within the community who can use it to the best advantage. However, there are times when the people can't use it to the best advantage. And in that case, an outsider, whether it be a journalist or an anthropologist or somebody else, can really help. So they'd be few and far between, but they do exist where people cannot use their own voices for a number of reasons.
Great. All right, we'll wrap up. Thank you so much, Julie, coming in. And I'll post the recording up on Canvas, so if you missed anything, you can go back and check it. And then for anyone who couldn't be here today, and hopefully you can join us again on Wednesday when Julie Spray is going to do a Zoom, only long distance Zoom, because Julie Spray is currently in the US.
Yes, poor Julie.
This has been good. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you very much for your questions. And I'll see you on Wednesday. Thank you, Julie. End the meeting.